So welcome back to the second half of the session on human rights institutions, successes and failures. Alors, bienvenue à la reprise de la session sur les institutions nationales, les réussites, les échecs. We started off the session talking about NGOs and their broad social role in society from one of the American leading rights organizations. We then moved to talking about one of the most contentious areas that we face, not only in North American society, but also globally, around religious rights and the role of a national institution in protecting religious freedoms, which Elizabeth Cassidy took us through. We then had a romp through what everything national institutions do or should do, which was brought to us by Mr. DeBress. And what I'd like to do now is to move to our next panelist, Pansy Lekula from South Africa, who is going to bring us to the next layer, if you will, of expose on what human rights institutions do. Now, she was one of the... She is currently the chief electoral officer at the Electoral Commission of South Africa, a member of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, and special rapporteur on freedom of expression and access to information in Africa. And in those three positions actually brings together a national institution, although focusing on electoral rights, a regional institution, namely the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, that encompasses the entire regional region of Africa in terms of its jurisdiction, and the international dimension, particularly with regard to freedom of expression and access to information. What this little blurb does not say is that she was also one of the founding members of the South African Human Rights Commission, and in that respect brings to us yet another dimension of our conversation and takes us to the next level, in the sense that the South African Commission does have that kind of broader role in terms of looking after and taking care of a much wider mandate of human rights at the national level as a national institution. So without further ado, I'm going to pass it on to Pansy to give us an overview of her experience and her sense of the successes and failures at these multiple levels.
Thank you very much, and good morning to everybody. Jarvis, you know, when you put up that slide on national institutions, I became very nostalgic when I saw the logo of the South African Human Rights Commission, because in 1995, I was a member of that commission, and we started from nothing. We only had the law that established us, the Constitution, and we had to start with coming up with a logo for our organization, and we commissioned a number of advertising agencies to come up with proposals, and that particular logo was done by a student of advertising, and among, I think, 20 or so that we received, we chose that one, and I'm still very, very proud of it, because I think it's a beautiful logo. The African Commission on Human and People's Rights is a treaty body on the African continent, established in terms of the African Charter on Human and People's Rights to promote and protect human rights on the African continent. It's one of the oldest organs of the African Union, or the Organization of African Unity, as it was then called. The commission is more than two decades old. The seat of the commission is Banjul, the Gambia, believe it or not. It's been situated there since its inception in the 1980s. I've had the privilege of being elected as a member of that commission, and I've been serving as a member for the past 5 years, where I also am responsible for freedom of expression and access to information as the special rapporteur of that mandate. I am also responsible for 5 countries, Namibia, Swaziland, Zambia, Mauritius, and the Gambia. Members of the commission serve for a term of 6 years, renewable once. One of the strategies that we adopted as a commission to enhance the effectiveness of the commission was to establish a number of special mechanisms. And apart from my special mechanism, we also have the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Women in Africa, Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders, Special Rapporteur on Prisons and Conditions of Detention, Special Rapporteur on Refugees, Asylum Seekers, Internally Displaced Persons, and Migrants. And the mandate holders are members of the Commission, unlike in the UN system. And in addition to these special rapporteurs, we've also established a number of working groups. A working group is chaired by a member of the Commission but consists of external experts. And we have a working group on the death penalty, on indigenous populations and communities, a working group on economic, social, and cultural rights, a working group on older persons and persons with disabilities, and a working group on extractive industries and human rights violations. And we have also committees, and the committees are the Committee on the Prevention of Torture, the Committee on the Protection of the Rights of People Living with HIV and Those at Risk. And also these committees are chaired by a member of the commission and consist of experts. I'm going to look at the relationship between my commission and national human rights institutions mainly. It's a relationship with state parties and its relationships with NGOs, international and national, and also try to look at some successes and challenges. I think, like all national institutions, one of the challenges that we faced with is that of independence, being able to execute your mandate independently, impartially, without free favor or prejudice. And as Joris pointed out, you know, in the national context, that also becomes very difficult, particularly in countries such as mine that have just emerged from the liberation struggle, where all of us were on the same side. Now, in that situation, if some people are then appointed as members of the National Human Rights Institution and are supposed to act independently and at times find against the government, it becomes very difficult. And that's where the labeling also comes up, by that you're selling out on the cause, you're going with the reactionaries and the liberals and, you know, all that in South Africa. So that's one of the most difficult parts of just being independent and walking the talk, substantive independence. You can have your independence in your constitution, in your enabling legislation, but I think you have to stay the course by walking the talk and taking difficult decisions and being true to your mandates. So I found that to be a challenge, both when I was a member of the African Commission of the Human Rights Commission, and also more so as a member of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. And as I said, the Commission has a mandate to protect and to promote human rights, which means we also act as a quasi-judicial body. And the state parties to the African Charter submit periodic reports to the Commission in the public sessions of the Commission, and we interrogate those reports. We also, in doing that, use the shadow reports that are given to us by NGOs, and that is where also some complication arises, particularly if those shadow reports are not completely accurate. And that's where the attacks and the labeling come up, and state parties defending themselves, bringing up context, talk about context to say, you see these NGOs, they do not understand the context within which we operate on the African continent, more so that we also have international NGOs that enjoy observer status with the Commission, and I'll come to that later. And we also have a relationship with national human rights institutions, because we grant affiliate status to these human rights institutions. I think one of the issues that the national human rights institutions have to confront is Where does their independence start and where does it end? When state parties submit reports to the commission, there is always that confusion whether a national institution is part of the government delegation or whether it is independent. And sometimes some national institutions, when state parties present their reports, they are part of the government reports. Other instances, they are not. And I think that's one of the issues that have to be resolved. And I think the second issue is that national human rights institutions can do more to assist bodies such as the African Commission to implement its recommendations, to follow up on the implementation of recommendations, to also follow up on lobby for the ratification of the treaties, and once the treaties have been ratified, for the domestication of those treaties. I think that also remains a big challenge. A very interesting relationship that we have is that with NGOs. And we grant observer status to NGOs, and we are quite flexible in the way we do it because we grant observer status to both national and international NGOs. We grant observer status to international NGOs that operate on the African continent. And if I look at the database of NGOs that have observer status with us, it looks like the international ones are actually overtaking the national ones in terms of the number of international NGOs that have observer status with us. And one of the challenges that we have is that our funding is very minimal. We are funded by the African Union as one of its organs. And that means, therefore, that at times we rely on donor funding for some of the projects that we do, such as workshops, conferences, publications, and also promotional activities and research and so forth. And this particular relationship that we have with NGOs has made state parties very uncomfortable that our agenda is driven by these NGOs that provide us with funding. And what complicates that relationship is that while these NGOs on one hand fund some of our promotional activities that I have mentioned, they also submit complaints of violations of human rights to the Commission on behalf of victims. And issues of incompatibility are often raised by state parties in this regard. And also there is also a perception on the African continent that NGOs and international NGOs in particular continue to influence the human rights agenda on the continent, and that national NGOs as well, particularly those that receive funding from outside, you know, they change their agenda depending on what their donors want them to do. And there are those concerns that are often raised by state parties. And this does not becomes even more complicated in repressive governments where the opposition is weak, where the NGO sort of occupies the space of a weak or non-existent opposition. Then, you know, you then don't know whether you are dealing with an NGO or with a political party because of the non-existence or weakness of opposition politics in a particular country. So because of this, there's a growing mistrust and intolerance by some governments on the African continent of international NGOs. And this results in what Paula has spoken about. Some of these NGOs are expelled from the countries where they operate. The case of Sudan is a case in point. And in some instances, the government then enacts or adopts very stringent laws that make it very difficult for these NGOs to continue to operate and to obtain registration status. And in all that, some of the governments are saying that these organizations use their resources to advance the agenda of the Western countries, and that they push particular human rights issues without fully understanding the context in which a particular country operates. I'm trying to skip some of the... Let me not skip too much because I'll get confused. So the relationship that the Commission has with NGOs has also been subjected to that whole criticism that our agenda is driven by these NGOs. And the NGOs, I must say that we have also had a very constructive relationship with them, particularly the special mechanisms, my mechanism in particular, and I will say a little bit more about that. And in fact, truth be told, without the support of the NGOs, I wouldn't have achieved, you know, some of our achievements. Just to give you an example of my mandate, the right to freedom of expression and access to information is contained in Article 9 of the Charter. You have to remember that the Charter was adopted many years ago, and there was a need to amplify the freedom of expression and access to information section in the Charter. And in 2002, the Commission adopted the Declaration on Principles on Freedom of Expression in Africa. And if one looks at that document, it's one of the most progressive documents on freedom of expression and access to information to come out of not only the African continent, but the world as a whole. And NGOs were responsible, really, very central in the development of this Declaration of Principles on Freedom of Expression. Another example, one of the most contentious issues on the African continent is the rights of indigenous people. Because of the perception or the belief that all Africans are indigenous to Africa. So you cannot have some people who have a higher status claiming to be indigenous. That's how the discourse goes in Africa. And we had to, you know, push and interpret the Charter purposefully and expansively to include the rights of indigenous people. And NGOs were very central to this, including in particular international NGOs as the acronym to this. It's a quite famous international NGO working on indigenous rights. NGOs have also lobbied us. The two working groups that we recently adopted, and we established these working groups in May at the May session, which is the Working Group on Extractive Industries and Human Rights Violations in Africa, and the Committee for the Protection of People Living with Disabilities and HIV and Those at Risk. We established these NGOs after intense, these committees, after intense lobbying by NGOs. And I have also, as I say, benefited. But what I have done is that I make sure that I set the agenda for my mandate. I set the agenda by adopting a plan of action. Once I've adopted that plan of action with clear priorities and outcomes, then partners can support me in executing that plan of action. And I find that that way of working keeps me in charge of my mandate so that I don't run this way and that way. For instance, one of the areas that I prioritized is the adoption of access to information legislation on the African continent, because very few countries on the continent have adopted access to information legislation. Those that have adopted this legislation do not even effectively implement the legislation. And one of the reasons that are advanced by countries on the African continent for absence of access to information legislation is to say we don't have a model law, a prototype African model law on access to information. We know that Article 19 has adopted some principles on access to information legislation. The World Bank Institute has also developed something. But I felt that probably the time has come for us to produce a model law on the continent on freedom of information, which can be used by governments to benchmark their own laws. And just in a week's time after I leave here, I'm going to convene a meeting of experts back at home, where from all regions of the continent, and we will look at a possible development of this access to information law. And in my capacity as the Special Rapporteur, I also write urgent letters of appeal on gross human rights violations, or on gross violations of the right to freedom of expression and access to information. And I rely a lot on information that is given to me by NGOs, and it is crucial for that information to be accurate, because if I act on exaggerated reports that are not accurate, of course the credibility of my mandate will be adopted. And even then, because I have to take up these cases without fear, favor, or prejudice, irrespective of where they arise. And one of the things that I also do proactively is also to analyze bills that are before national parliaments to look at whether those bills comply with international instruments, particularly the African Charter. And I brought this just to show practical. After I do the analysis, I then issue a press release to say this is what I've done. In my country, for instance, many years ago, we adopted the access to information legislation, which is one of the most progressive access to information legislation on the African continent, and I think even globally. Now, the gains that we have made in that area, we seem to be, you know, taking a few steps back. We are undermining those gains, because before our parliament is the Protection of Information Bill, which seeks to bring back the culture of secrecy. You know, it gives wide powers to heads of organs of state to classify information and so forth. And I wrote a letter of appeal to President Zuma to just point out what the weaknesses were in that proposed bill and how those weaknesses can also be addressed. And this is what came out of, you see, Tlakula appeals to Zuma to change the media bill. Of course, the media will call it a media bill, the protection of information. I mean, access to information is not only a media right, it's a right for everybody, but that's a debate for another day. So these are the kind of things that I do. I have to do this. Then the debate arises. People say, how can you do this? You conflicted because you're South African. And what confuses the whole thing, then people say the chief elections officer of South Africa has done this, and people say, how can she do this because next year she's going to be running elections? But I say, no, I do this in my capacity as the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression. As a member of the African Commission, in that commission, I serve in my personal capacity. I don't represent my country. Now, NGOs, there are instances where they have failed to influence the commission to deal with certain human rights issues. LGBTI rights is a case in point, where NGOs have tried, they've tried to apply for observer status. I spoke about this NGO, which is a coalition of African lesbian. They tried to apply, they failed. NGOs also submitted an advisory opinion to try and convince the commission on how LGBTI rights are entrenched in the African Charter, but they haven't won. That battle is ongoing. And I also want to say that context, I think this issue of context worries me a lot. We have to take into consideration the context in which the countries are operating, but that context should never be used to undermine human rights. The context should be used to advance human rights. Because if you go to Zimbabwe, the land question in Zimbabwe, we know the political context of that, of the land issue. And that problem has to be resolved. But you cannot resolve it by violating rights. In South Africa, we have an infinitely irresponsible media that reports inaccurately in an exaggerated manner, that does not you know, observe media ethics. I'm making a generalization, not all of them, some of them. We have to address that. We have the press ombudsman, we have the press council. These bodies have not been effective in dealing with these problems. Now, what are we doing? We say, in order to deal with this, we now have to come up with a statutory media appeals tribunal. Is that the answer? Maybe not. Let's look at other ways of holding the media accountable and making it more efficient and professional. Now, let me, as I conclude, look at the successes. I think the successes that we've had as the African Commission on Human and People's Rights is that we are accessible to the authorities. We are accessible to governments. So we are able to raise human rights issues directly with authorities, presidents, and so forth. I think that's a plus. And we can resolve human rights disputes in a cost-effective way, including through dispute resolution mechanisms. Sessions of the Commission provide NGOs with an opportunity and platform to interact and engage with their governments on human rights issues. And in some countries, that's the only platform that you have. You never see your Minister of Human Rights or of Justice unless, you know, at the sessions of the Commission. So that we have provided that platform. And thematic approach to human rights through the creation of special mechanisms has enhanced the effectiveness of the Commission because you can focus on a mandate and drive that mandate effectively. And also that we have countries that we oversee. But we have a number of challenges, and maybe we have more challenges than successes. And these challenges are not just applicable to us, but also to some of the UN bodies as well. And the first one that I want to put on the table is lack of transparency in identifying candidates for appointment to these institutions. We don't know how people are nominated. You just hear that Pensi Tlakula is now a member of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. Nationally, there is no transparent process that says to the country, okay, let's bring a number of names together, and out of these names in South Africa, let's take this one and submit it. So I think, and in some instances, candidates themselves even approach governments. You can go to a government and say, if you have a good relationship, go to the government and say, can you please nominate me? And it goes, you know, and become a member of the commission. The second challenge is the political nature of the appointment process, I think, because the appointment of these people, whether at UN or AU, takes intense lobbying by state parties. They lobby others to say, can you support my candidates? And it's a give and take, and they can come to a conclusion and say, okay, I'll support you on this one if you support me on this other one. We know what happens. And this process takes into consideration, in some instances, regional representativity rather than expertise that a person has on human rights. You can say, okay, Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression came from Africa, you know, for the past 4 years, so it has to go to Asia. And whoever Asian candidate is there will make it. And what complicates is we are nominated based on our CVs, and we are elected without presenting ourselves for an interview. And issues of compatibility also arise, because in some instances you find that certain categories of people are not qualified for nomination. If you are a government official, an ambassador, for instance, you can't be a member of the commission. But if you don't disclose that in your CV, nobody will know whether you are compatible or not, and you can go. Or sometimes when you go in, you are not incompatible, you subsequently become incompatible because you are now, say, appointed as Attorney General of your country. If you decide not to resign, there is nothing that we can do. We rely on your good faith and integrity to say, I am now incompatible, let me leave the commission. But some people don't do that. I think other challenges is that countries ratify instruments but they don't domesticate them. Or once they've domesticated them, implementation remains a big challenge. I think also the implementation of the recommendations that we make out of fact-finding missions, promotional missions, and so on, examination of reports, we make many recommendations. These recommendations are hardly implemented by states parties. Our follow-up mechanisms for implementation of our recommendations are not effective as well. We don't have quite effective implementation. So this leaves victims of violations of human rights without an effective remedy. I've spoken about lack of financial resources. On the African continent, we now have the African Court on Human and People's Rights, which is supposed to complement our protective mandates. The Commission can take cases to the court. What is the problem here? The problem is that the protocol that establishes the court says that victims of human rights violations and NGOs can only have direct access to the court if a state party, upon ratification of that protocol or immediately thereafter, signs a declaration that gives NGOs and victims direct access to that court. Now, to date, only 5 countries on the African continent have signed that declaration, so it doesn't look like that court is going to be effective. My last point. Look, the Commission over the years has done a lot of work and has developed very rich jurisprudence under extremely difficult circumstances. We have to support the work of the Commission. The Commission is ours, and we have to make sure that it works effectively. That's the only institution that we have. We serve on a part-time basis. I'm the Chief Elections Officer of South Africa. I serve the African Commission part-time. The mandate is overwhelming, but we do our best to protect and promote the rights of African people. Thank you.
So you just heard from somebody with expertise in a National Human Rights Commission with a broad mandate, a specialized national institution with an electoral mandate, a regional mechanism, and a special rapporteur mechanism at the regional level. You got 4 in one, and she did it on time. So thank you, Pansy. A couple of things that I think were particularly interesting in the train of the remarks that we've just heard. The first one is that once commissions start to have, or institutions start to have the capacity to accept complaints, individual complaints, and launch investigations, the allegations around conflict of interest, mandates that are incompatible, start to become much more pronounced. And that's because interests are at stake. Commissions are in an unenviable, I can never say that word properly, unenviable position, because nobody likes them, ever, really. Governments fund them, but of course governments are the respondents to most human rights complaints. Respondents feel that because commissions will often work with and support complainants to the process, that they are biased in favor of complainants. When commissions work with, and all of them do, respondent communities in order to do public education work, they're accused by complainants of being biased towards employer and respondent communities. NGOs systematically attack and accuse human rights commissions of not being progressive enough. Conservative elements who are focused on business interests are concerned about the costs that are imposed on businesses. And so the left bring critiques, the right bring critiques, the government is not supportive, and indeed will often look for opportunities to reduce the effectiveness of institutions, partly at the instigation of both the left and the right, NGOs and community organizations working on both sides. It's a very, very tough position to be in. When you're working at the level Pansy is working at, you then get geometric progressions of those kinds of criticisms at virtually every level, from national to international, which I think adds a series of dimensions to that, which makes it even more complex to manage. I was smiling when she was talking about the difficulty when you're filing your reports or shadow reports to international communities, because this is not an issue that is restricted to Africa. In Canada, when I was at the Ontario Human Rights Commission, for the first time in the late 90s, we wrote a report to one of the treaty body committees expressing our concern about the way the Ontario government at the time, the Harris government, was dealing with vulnerable and marginalized communities, particularly poor people, and the way they were impacted. It had never been done before that a commission in Canada had actually, in Ontario at least, had sent a report forward to the international community. And so when the Ontario government packaged all of its stuff together, it stamped our report as being the report of the Ontario government. This was reported on the Globe and Mail afterwards, and this created great confusion, because when it arrived in Geneva, the officials opened it and read it and thought, wow, this government is really able to criticize itself and honest, and this is transparency at its best, and then sent the commentary back to the Ontario government, who, of course, went into apoplexy. Which then arrived on my desk. So these kinds of new developments in terms of the roles of commissions, create a little bit of sand in the gears when things change and when organizations try to take up these kinds of challenges. So, on to our next participant, and there has been some concern expressed on behalf of a couple of our speakers to make sure that we get to you very quickly. So. Frederick has agreed to limit his remarks to around 20 minutes, and then we want to get it over to you so that you can respond to these provocative representations that have been made. And Frederick is a professor at McGill University, an expert in human rights matters, but not only in academic, and I don't say only in a pejorative sense, but has also had practical experience on the ground working with, among others, the United Nations. And that brings us to the next level of our discussion about the role of human rights institutions' successes and failures. So I'll pass it over to Frederick.
Thanks a lot for the introduction, Pearl, and don't hesitate to sort of enforce the 20-minute discipline.
No worries.
No worries, good. I understood the idea of human rights institutions as meaning, at least for purposes of this presentation, international human rights institutions, and I thought I'd present some of the developments there. I have to admit, it's one thing that strikes me about the word institution is the, like, I think the very idea that we should institutionalize human rights is an interesting idea. That you might think that most human rights advances that have occurred have not occurred thanks to institutions. They've occurred because of revolutions, because of social movements. They've occurred. They've come from the streets and from sort of direct political action. And of course, sort of the institutions come relatively late in the day, and obviously have a role to fulfill in solidifying that promise, because we can't always be making revolutions and demonstrations and the like. But it's important to see, but to suspect that institutionalization will come at a cost, which is that precisely you won't be in that sort of fundamentally creative, constitutive moment all the time, and there's a time when you need to formalize things, and maybe you'll lose some of the energy of the movement as a result. So I want to do two things. I plan on doing three, but I'll only do two. I want to contextualize the rise of international human rights institutions and suggest some of the reasons why I think they emerged, and then I want to assess some of the costs and benefits of having international institutionalization of human rights. And I don't think we should take it for granted that it's always a good thing to both internationalize and institutionalize human rights, and that in fact, sometimes a mixture of the two leads to quite perplexing results. So the story of internationalizing and creating international institutions for human rights is in some ways quite a heroic story. And if you think of the 19th century, you think of the Vienna Conference, you think of a world composed of states, no one was interested in human rights. There's a very small mention in the Vienna Declaration in 1815 that it might be a good idea to do something about slavery one day, but there's really no pressure on anyone to sort of take immediate measures. And of course, for states at the time, this was totally besides the point of international law and international life as a matter that is purely a sovereign matter. And that changes very, very slowly because there's a lot of defense of sovereignty. It changes maybe in the late 19th century with the idea that at least we should regulate the way war is waged and maybe protect civilians, but not much more than that. And so I think what's interesting is the history of taking human rights into account internationally, which only really picks up after the Second World War, is part of a history of international institutionalization in general, right? Which starts in the 19th century, you know, with the Danube Commission and the International Postal Union, things that have nothing to do with human rights. The League of Nations does just a little bit, but the League of Nations is not really interested in human rights. It's interested in minorities, which is not quite the same thing, although it's very interesting from a point of view of the general theme of this conference, that this is so became so out of fashion after the Second World War. We didn't really want to hear about minorities as such anymore. We just concentrate on individual freedoms. And so that story of institutionalization goes on with, really picks up with the creation of the United Nations. As you know, human rights have a bit of an ambiguous place within the UN Charter. There's one of the zillion things that the UN is supposed to do, many of which are probably perceived as more important at the time by many states, international peace and security being the sort of the most important goal maybe, but also development, culture, health, etc. And it's very difficult and problematic for human rights to gain attention and a foothold within that context. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is the beginning, but it takes, you know, it's not binding. It takes another 20 years before the first treaties are adopted. So it's a very, very slow process. And then we get to the Vienna Convention in 1993, where there's really an affirmation by the UN that, you know, human rights is actually fairly serious and fairly important to the UN. So the High Commissioner is created, which is quite important. It means it's no longer simply a department within the Secretariat General, but it's very sensitive to the political priorities of the organization, but it's kind of starting to become its own thing within the UN structure. And you know, there's a real dilemma still today within the United Nations, which is, are human rights just one activity among many? Okay, but can be sort of segmented and compartmentalized to a degree. Or is it, you know, fundamentally what all of the UN should be about? So is it just, you know, the Human Rights Council and assorted organizations, or should we be mainstreaming human rights throughout departments and organizations linked to the UN? So overall, I mean, you can see that there's a progression, and human rights keep becoming more and more central to what the UN does. And there's certainly many sort of positive side effects to that from a point of view of human rights. The most clear one is from the moment that human rights are discussed globally, it becomes very difficult for states to argue that issues involving their populations, their individuals, are fundamentally part of their domaine réservé, that they're fundamentally issues that are covered by sovereignty. Right? Human rights has been internationalized once and for all, and so it makes it harder, not impossible, but harder to make arguments that, you know, inquiring about the human rights record of a particular state is interference in sovereign affairs. And the UN and regional organizations have been quite successful in a number of areas. I would say they've been very successful at standard setting, with sort of, you know, more and more instruments, treaties, declarations, etc. Not quite as good as at enforcement, although there's been a lot of progress, particularly in regional systems. And you can see that overall, all of this, however incomplete it may be, is an improvement on state-to-state human rights enforcement. You can see that the UN will always have a bit more, or the African Union, or the Council of Europe, has a little more authority to complain about human rights violations within a particular state, because it's talking for a plurality of members. It's harder for these international organizations to be entirely identified with the political agenda of a particular state. At the same time, I think there are costs to international institutionalization, and I would say they're both the costs of institutionalizing and the costs of internationalizing. So first, I think in terms of institutionalizing, there's a real risk, perhaps, of excessive technocratization of human rights. And, you know, I'm always struck by, you know, terms like human rights committee or human rights council or truth commission or freedom house. I mean, there's a way in which sort of technocratic language and human rights sort of seem to fuse, but it's not always very felicitous. And I say this in the sense that you know, maybe we're sort of putting the technocrats and the lawyers a little too much in charge, and that might have demobilizing effects. It might, you know, lead us into the sort of a false sense that, you know, someone's in charge and someone's doing something, and you know, it's all about the laws and adjudication and implementing treaties, etc. So a very sort of mechanical approach to human rights that maybe kills, I'd almost be tempted to say, kills the fun out of human rights, right? That kills the sense of this being about struggles and fights and social movements, etc. So that's a risk. A second risk might be, and this goes back to something that was said in the first session yesterday, that human rights is, of course, part of the sort of politics of depoliticization, right? We actually know what the goals are, and the goals are human rights, and the role of polities, the role of sovereigns, is merely to implement a program that we've now sort of, you know, decided is the right program, and that's awfully demobilizing for democracy and sort of political life and sovereignty in general, right? And in fact, Pearl, you said, yeah, you used the term at one point, you said, I think it was in relation to National Human Rights Commissions, and I think it was you said, well, are they buffers or conduits? So you didn't really present it as an alternative, or I really think it is an alternative. So either they are conduits, and they're just sort of a conveyor belt for something that's been determined internationally, and it's just, you know, top-down, implement the treaties, sort of do as you're told, or they're buffers, which is kind of an interesting concept. In fact, they're sort of, they also, the sovereign also, populations, etc., also have a role in resisting what, you know, being the sort of, sure, they're being pressured to adopt and translating it and vernacularizing it, to use Sally Angle Mary's term. And that's something that's not a dimension that maybe isn't brought out as much as it should be. Finally, there's, I think, with institutionalization and technocratization and sort of focus on legal standards, and I'm a lawyer, so, you know, I'm not arguing for my corporation here. I think that it's sometimes part of a problem. I think there's also a risk of standardized solutions and artificial decomplexification of human rights. And as reminded, and I, of course, as soon as we institutionalize, we have no choice than to adopt some of these measures and indicators and try to measure, you know, freedom of expression and freedom of thought, for example. And it's awfully useful to have these statistics, etc. At the same time, you know, I can't help thinking that we're dealing with profoundly contested concepts. Freedom, for one, you know, is. I mean, we all claim, and I think to a degree might recognize fundamental violations of freedom when we see them. At the same time, we know these things are extremely complicated. Are we talking about the freedom of the ancients or the freedom of the moderns? Are we talking about Rousseau's freedom or Locke's freedom? Are we talking about freedom as self-determination of the people or just sort of private individual liberties? You know, how do we assess freedom, you know, in Iraq under occupation? You know, do we measure it by the number of newspapers that have blossomed, or do we take into account the fact we have an occupied country, right? And, you know, is there tension there? I mean, all of these things. So we're dealing with real debates. You know, freedom of expression, and I was interested by the earlier presentation, but, you know, some countries have hate speech laws, and that might be seen, if you're coming from a U.S. tradition of First Amendment, as, you know, sort of a limitation on freedom of expression. You know, I happen to come from France, where we actually think that it's an offense to deny the Holocaust, and I think that's a defensible point of view. Right? You know, I think should definitely fall within the margin of appreciation, but, you know, it's part of, it's not really a legitimate exercise of freedom of expression. I know the ICCPR also says that, you know, campaigning in favor of genocide or war should not be covered by freedom of expression. And you could go on, right? I mean, freedom of religion, the veil debate and its many various forms. Do we take into account the fact that, to go back to context, I don't think context should be an excuse to violate human rights, but context exists. Some societies are attached to a particular view, you know, I don't know, Turkey, France, etc., to a particular view of secularism, which you can one can disagree with, but isn't reducible to, you know, the simple question of whether a right has been violated or not. I mean, there's societal choices that are involved that are quite complex. I see that as all of these are sort of problems with institutionalization and of the language of human rights, and maybe a failure to sort of address some of the underlying political issues. Now, there are also potential downsides to internationalization. And there's nothing obvious about internationalization. No one forced us to do this. We've sort of willed this, and now it's a fact of international life that human rights are part of the discourse. But it does come at considerable cost. And I think one of the reasons why human rights, there's many internationalized, is because you need to kind of circumvent the state, right? You need to appeal to something higher than the state. And the international community is a natural ally as part of that strategy. And also because human rights needs power. I mean, human rights is an ideology. It started as being very weak and marginal always, and needs power to have clout, to be heard, etc. And the problem, of course, is that there's some sort of Faustian bargains involved, that you kind of need power to make human rights real, and you have to make agreements with the powerful. And then, you know, the powerful are probably going to have their conditions, and they love, of course, nothing more than, a legitimizing discourse for their own power. So we have lots of only alliances between human rights and power. Power might be powerful states, it might be powerful constituencies, it might be powerful organizations. But I think there's a risk of corruption, and certainly, you know, when you look at the Human Rights Council and sort of the attempts to reform it, you can see that the strong identification of human rights and some state agendas, it creates a spectacle that's not, I think, always great for human rights. Another risk of internationalization, this is quite different, might be excessive huge generalizations, okay, that to agree to anything in terms of human rights at the international level, you need to kind of dilute the formula to make it palatable to everyone. And, you know, you go to the regional level, you already need to sort of, you know, make lots of compromises, etc. By the time you reach the universal level, you're really talking about the lowest common denominator. And there's a real risk that international human rights at a certain level of universal abstraction really means very little, and you kind of find yourself longing for the moment when human rights are brought back to the ground and concretized again. I'll mention one more risk, or one or two, before I finish. I think one of them is linked to this imbrication of politics and human rights at the international level being always a locus of politics and power rivalry, is the danger of stigmatization, the danger that human rights will be used as a discourse that serves to describe an us, an unproblematized us versus an unproblematized them. And I think there's a lot of that going on. I think it's very tempting, and we have to be a little wary. And it works in both ways and in all directions. But everyone has a certain idea of who we is and why, you know, a particular system is more conducive to human rights. I wonder sometimes about some of our sort of single-minded obsessions about particular human rights violations, however horrendous they may be, at the expense of all others. I mean, there's a lot of politics involved. I mean, how should I put it? Everyone, and this is a phenomenon in Europe that's quite evident, and maybe more. It's what I call human rights populism. Okay, every populist today, including people who are traditionally not interested in human rights at all, has become a sort of human rights defender. You think of Geert Wilders in the Netherlands and other sort of and a number of Islamophobic groups in Europe who are not particularly well known for their support of women's rights, all of a sudden reinvent themselves as women's rights defenders, right? And why do they reinvent themselves as women's rights defenders? Not because they finally notice that women in France are not paid as much at similar levels as men, and they think, you know, that conjugal violence or domestic violence is a real problem. It's because there's an agenda and they're trying to tell us something about what they think a certain community is doing that they think is not like us and is not really European, etc., etc. Okay. So I think that's that danger, and that's amplified internationally, I think, where human rights sort of lends itself to some of these manipulations, and human rights activists are sometimes instrumentalized and not putting up enough of the resistance. And of course, the most obvious manifestation of this in the international level is human rights becoming every sort of cannon wielder's, you know, best excuse to go to war. And we've seen this, and not that it's not a big debate, and that, you know, it might not be justified in certain circumstances. But you have to be, as a human rights sort of, you know, someone who believes in human rights, a little worried when it's language that is used as part of sort of, you know, muscular, liberal international narrative to justify occupation, to justify the use of force in contravention of a charter, etc. All right, so well, I've done my 20 minutes, so I'll just stop here. I had a conclusion, but
okay.
I'm 25, yeah.
You've got 2 more minutes.
2 more minutes, all right, sorry. All right, here's, yeah, so to finish on a more positive note, sorry, because I was a bit somber to finish. All right, so. No, because as a human rights lawyer, kind of expected to always finish with somewhat optimistically. It's part of a movement. So, a few ideas about what we can do to sort of rejuvenate the promise of international institutionalized human rights. And I think it's about asking certain questions. And they're quite simple, and we just need to sort of keep asking them. The first is, who speaks? Okay. It's not just about the proposition. It's what the proposition is coming out of. And, you know, there's lots of issues. It might be what state is speaking, what professional group is speaking. And this has long been an issue in international human rights. NGOs were shut out from the international human rights discourse for a long time. Now they're omnipresent, but now's the time to ask, who are the NGOs, and, you know, who are they speaking for, and who are they, and what's their legitimacy, etc. The second issue is what's the standard? So what's the standard? So to talk about human rights in general is fairly easy. I think things become very complicated when we're dealing with human rights violations, and we're trying to reconcile the extreme diversity of the planet and cultures, etc., with single instruments. And there's a lot of talk, for example, in the European context of the margin of appreciation. And I think that's a reasonable notion, right? That it's not about abolishing the international altogether and forming one single, you know, cosmopolity that, you know, abides by exactly the same human rights standards. It's about understanding what human rights mean in different systems. The problem, of course, with the margin of appreciation is it can then quickly become a way of legitimizing almost anything and being apologetic about whatever system is in place. And since, you know, to go back to the overall theme of the conference and the idea of social diversity, I know the European Court of Human Rights, when, you know, dealing with a veil issue in Turkey, you may know the Shane decision, had, you know, basically started from what Turkey is, right, which is a secular society that has a certain interest in preventing the resurgence of an Islamic threat, etc., then said, on that basis, given that this is what Turkey is, I'm simplifying here, it's okay to deny woman wearing the veil their diploma because they refused to take the veil off to get their end of university picture taken, right? So that's margin of appreciation. Language, I think, sort of become gone wrong, that you accept too much of the domestic reality, and it can easily justify almost anything. And the last question is, who's responsible? Who's responsible when things go wrong, when human rights violations occur? And I think here we're really on the verge of some absolutely major changes, that the default position of international human rights for the best part of the last 200 years has been, let's go to the state. Human rights are about the state. And this is, of course, paradoxical, that human rights sort of keeps legitimizing what it's simultaneously going up against. But increasingly in a globalized world where the state matters, but not as much as it once did, we're looking for other targets. And there's a sense that the targets are moving all the time, but it is really becoming an issue. I mean, one of the issues is the UN ever responsible for human rights? Are regional organizations ever responsible for human rights? I mentioned just in passing, because I love that anecdote. So the UN, of course, in the last 50 years has a fantastic experience in promoting respect for human rights within countries and by countries. Right? Then the UN gets Kosovo and is put in charge of Kosovo and becomes effectively the sovereign in Kosovo. Right? It gets to do what states normally do. And of course, the first thing that Kushner does as the new emperor of Kosovo is he adopts a law that allows him to lock people away on administrative grounds if they're perceived as a threat to security with no appeal, etc. Right? So certainly international organizations are not above doing the very things that they've criticized, and I could come up with other examples. So that's going to be an issue. But it's not only about intergovernmental organizations. It's also about corporations and other new actors. Thanks a lot for your patience, Pearl. Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I'm really happy he took that last 5 minutes. So we've kind of gone from the streets to the summit of international human rights. We've gone from thinking about human rights as being a movement that comes from associations of people through NGOs to international institutions. What I'd like to do for the last half hour is turn it over to you, and what I would propose we do, and I hope I'll be able to see you all okay, but is to take questions in groups of three, then ask all the panelists to respond as they see fit. Of course, if you have a question directed to one person, please indicate that, and then we'll go through that process with your permission, if that's acceptable to you, for the next half hour. So, over to you, questions. And I can't see a thing. There we go. Yeah, that's right. Thanks. Line up at the mics if you've got questions.
Hi. My name is Bill Shipley. I'm from Chicago. I'm a student at the Faculty of Law. And I just want to throw out some two ways of looking at human rights commissions, like from the experience that I've had from where I'm from, as being positive and negative. The negative is the Martin Luther King's housing campaign in Chicago at the end of the 60s. His frustration with the Daley administration at being very smarter in terms of instead of directly attacking them with billy clubs like they did in the South, they just made a commission. And they said, that's kind of where human rights complaints will, go to die, death by commission. And then the contrary example is the police torture that we had a serious problem in Chicago for a number of years. There was a police commander by the name of John Birch who systematically tortured suspects into confessions, and the fact that many of these were subsequently overturned led to the moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois, which was later extended to many other states as they made similar discoveries. But the Jewish Council of Urban Affairs in Illinois actually used the UN reporting process, and I'm not sure which mechanism it was, but essentially shaming Chicago into finally investigating these things seriously. And a lot of times it was just a question of credibility, and it was really unfortunate that the news media and the criminal justice system within the state of Illinois pretty much took the word of the police over the word of the suspect or after suspect, invariably non-white, primarily black and Latino, basically taking their word over that of countless people, and it's kind of demonstrative of the problems that we continue to have. But I think that a lot of times the attitude that citizens may adopt when you rely too much on governmental structures is this idea of rights as some kind of transaction, something that's given or granted by government or by some external body, as opposed to something that's inherent to every individual human being, regardless of where they're from or what jurisdiction they're in. And trying to enable the individual abilities of people to advocate on their own behalf, and kind of increasing the self-determination of individuals acting collectively or spontaneously to recognize those violations and not necessarily take as much of a positivist approach of, we need to define the problem this way and then we investigate it that way, or define rights within this context, because obviously the nature of rights is very much, you have a lot of overlap depending on the context. And, one individual can have a whole bundle of rights that, depending on whether they're at work or home or housing or whatever it is, and a lot of times I think it might be more effective rather than trying to define the discourse and create an institutional structure around that, to instead create ways to improve people's freedom of association and self-expression, to call attention to these things themselves. And so I wanted to ask, what are some of the ways that the panel members might think that we can approach things, or human rights commissions could approach things more from that perspective, as a means of empowerment as opposed to a means of defining problems and creating institutions that are invariably kind of undermined depending on the political ramifications of whatever it is that they're tasked with doing. So,
great. Two more questions.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Vladarczyk. I'm a law student at the University of Montreal. So a few of the panelists spoke really briefly about the Human Rights Council, and I don't have so much of a question as more an asking the panelists to sort of share their thoughts and comments about the Human Rights Council, and more specifically about the Universal Periodic Review. And if I could ask you to focus even more closely on the role of NGOs in the review, as well as, and I wrote this down so I could say it properly, the successes and failures of the attempt to depoliticize the mechanism of human rights review while keeping it institutionalized. Thank you.
And the third one.
Hi, my name is Damir Hadžić. I come from Bosnia. I would like to direct a question to Professor Magre. It's regarding the things that you mentioned, they were very interesting. Who has the right to speak and where do the responsibilities lie? If I can give a personal experience, well, not a personal, of my country's experience, we have a protectorate, so we're not really a sovereign country. But we were given a constitution that says that all the things said in the European Convention on Human Rights are directly applicable in our own law. So technically speaking, we have a person who has been put in charge of the country that has at its disposal the entire European Convention on Human Rights, decides not to pursue the course of action that will protect all human rights, rather sets up commissions, human rights of different kinds and nature, that are kind of toothless. So where does the responsibility lie there? Because he is put in charge on behalf of the Peace Implementation Council, which is the members of different countries, who are all vicious proponents of the Human Rights Charter and these issues. It does ring a bell of what you, Lady Chairman, had said, that it's not a buffer zone that we're talking about. It's actually more of a kind of putting aside what is the real agenda of the international community and then leaving human rights to be presented as a we've done another part that makes things better for the country. That would be just your comment. Thank you.
So I'm going to ask the panelists to respond to the first three questions before moving on to the next group, if I may. Thank you. So the first question had to do with really Frederic's point about the technocratization. there's a lot of nouns that he used that I don't think I could get my head around. But the institutionalization of rights to the point where you attach all of your disputes to a single hook, and that hook then starts to sag under the weight, not only become very effective, but also starts to fall apart, I think is a great question, and one I think I'd like to hear everybody on. Second question on the effectiveness of the UPR and whether it is indeed depoliticized, again, for everyone. And then the third question on the sort of Bosnian who's responsible question to Professor McGrath. So I'm going to open up the session on the first question of kind of the institutionalization impacts, and maybe I can just suggest that we sort of start at the end of the table and just work our way down.
Can I defer to the second question?
Sure. As you wish.
When we're ready.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought I'd rather focus on the second question.
If I were you, I would,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah, I mean, I actually also sort of feel like I have more answers to the second than the first, given, you know, sort of my experience. Our entity doesn't really do what he's asking about.
A couple of thoughts in regards to the first question is one that I want to highlight, which is it's a little bit related to your point, which is one of the things that when Freedom House evaluates the state of human rights, we evaluate the state of human rights, not the state necessarily. This is something that's often confused by governments who read our evaluation as a direct critique on their performance. It is true, of course, that states play an inordinate, naturally, role in regards to whether or not people experience human rights and freedoms within a country context, but there are many other things that can impact people's human rights and levels of freedom, including non-state actors, including conflicts with other states, including criminal organizations, all kinds of things, including occupation, of course. And just briefly, in response to your point about that before, we recognize that occupation can have a very negative impact on people's ability to experience freedom, just as security issues can have a negative impact on people to experience freedom. Even if the legal environment is supposed to be quite positive, the reality is, and we grade as such, that if people are fundamentally insecure, it negatively impacts a whole range of our checklist of questions of rights that we look at. So countries like, for instance, Iraq and Afghanistan rate quite low on our freedom index, and in fact, Iraq actually went down during some of the more insecure parts of the occupation. I think what you're really getting at is how beyond just an enforcement legal mechanism, how do you get people to actually engage in their human rights? And that is, I would actually say, the majority of what Freedom House does on our programming side, which is really helping civil society activists be able to get out there and engage their constituencies and their societies. And there's no lack of creative ideas. A lot of what we do is simply provide some solidarity. We provide a lot of networking. We encourage people to get out there and engage in fundamental freedoms, which is as important as the part where we censor and criticize and look at sort of the legal aspects of whether or not rights are being respected, if that answers that question. Are we just sticking with question one?
Just because they're quite different. Just a couple of thoughts, if I may abuse my moderator's position since the first two skipped. The question about institutionalizing rights and whether it's appropriate and the kind of moribund state that technocrats sometimes get into when they take the fun out of the job is a big one. But a couple of thoughts about that. The first one is that there is supposed to be no right without a remedy. And if you do have a right, it means you need to be able to go somewhere. Now, that could be a human rights commission. It could be a court. The same comments you made about commissions, of course, would have applied to courts for a range of other rights. And so there's a real question about how you make rights real and the extent to which it's important to be able to have the traction to take a claimed right and to make it something that you can remedy. So that's kind of a first response to that. And the second one is that one of the things that commissions do, which is unusual for a regulatory body with a public interest mandate, which to some extent is what they are, is that it actually doesn't always, in fact, most of the time, in jurisdictions like ours, I say North America, for example, is it doesn't rely on itself, i.e. the institution, to go out and affect that right, make that right real, or affect that remedy. What it does is it empowers individual citizens to come forward, not only to file the complaint and take it upon themselves, but also to engage a public discourse around the type of right they're asserting, whether that right is appropriate. And Human Rights Commission's complaints tend to get a lot of public space and debate because of that. And so a lot of questions about how far commissions are pushing the envelope are taking place within a dialogue around a statutory framework where citizens have been given the capacity to take those rights in hand and make them real. So I think that's something that's worth considering. And then there's an academic at the University of Ottawa called Lucie Lamarche who's got a very interesting thesis about the fact that we tend to put too much on the hook of human rights commissions. We tend to put too much weight on it because we don't have a multiplicity of different kinds of institutions to resolve these disputes, and that we should be mainstreaming human rights commission human rights issues more. And that's an interesting perspective, and I think one that speaks to some of the issues that you rose. So a couple of thoughts on that.
You know, I'm sitting and thinking, because some of us in areas where we operate, we deal with matters of life and death. And you don't have the opportunity to reflect on some of the intellectual issues around these issues. When you're dealing with a journalist who's facing a death penalty for publishing an article that is critical to government, your thought is, I have to get this person out of the situation in which they are. And that's where I operate, unfortunately, with quite serious violations of human rights, of the right to freedom of expression. And you don't even have the latitude, you know, some of the issues that you raise, because the issues of life and death of people who are imprisoned, people who can also be killed, and you have to find a solution and use your office to the best of your ability to get those people out of the situation in which they are. I just thought I wanted to share that with you.
If I can add to that, and I think that's true of all human rights systems, what you see with the European Court of Human Rights, for example, is, of course, it does a lot more than that. So there are still, I mean, even in Strasbourg, life and death issues, but there's also huge issues that are now systematically framed as rights issues, but are really, you know, issues of social organization, of division, separation of power, of organization of the economy, of organization of labor, etc. And I think it's for these issues that you know, we need to sort of constantly rethink the role that we're assigning to human rights to sort of resolve some of these disputes. To go back to the question, I think so. Individual petitions and the idea of empowering individuals is typically what's promoted, and we see it as a weakness of human rights protection mechanisms when they don't allow for that. And I think individual petition is great. Its only shortcoming, you know, is that it's quite individual, and so it's reliant on the willingness of an individual to press a claim, which may not always be available. So, of course, the Human Rights Commission Council can sort of analyze patterns of individual petitions rather than just individual ones, and that's maybe the aggregate is more interesting. Maybe one thing I'd like to say is, you need a bit of everything, right? So, but to counteract the excessive individualization of rights litigation, interestingly, what you need is human rights commissions. And interestingly, in Europe, they've fused the systems, and now they only have a court, and that's held up as, you know, the presented as the lead to follow, etc. And I think it would be very problematic in many places to abolish the commission, because the commission has a different mandate. It's not, there's structural issues, there's issues, there's cross-cutting issues that need to be observed and analyzed together, that are not reducible to individual violation. So, you know, that part of my response would be we still need that panoramic and sort of policy-oriented view alongside individual petitions.
Great addition. UPR, who'd like to jump in?
Yes, I had the privilege of being at the United Nations Human Rights Council to observe some of the first universal periodic reviews, which is the new system of reviewing every member of the United Nations on their human rights performance. And I had a mixed reaction. There was a very interesting review of South Africa. There's also a review of Great Britain and the Netherlands, and with my own Dutch origin, I paid particular attention there, and I was surprised, in fact, that one of the issues raised by another state on the Human Rights Council was why the Netherlands hadn't reintroduced the death penalty. And I think that's what sort of led me, and I think there were a number of issues in the first round of universal periodic reviews, which when you put states together and get them to ask each other about their human rights performance, you get some interesting results. But it's an imperfect system, but it has enabled, it has produced a process of peer accountability, which requires every state to examine its own human rights record, to report on it. It requires them to consult with the public and to report on that consultation. And it requires them to make commitments about what they'll do about issues that they've identified. And it also leaves room for a human rights institution to both make its own submission and for NGOs and to have voice at the Human Rights Council. And so we found the process for New Zealand extremely helpful in having a discussion, first of all, with government, and then facilitating public and NGO discussion, then preparing our own report and assisting and encouraging NGOs to prepare their reports. It was useful in terms of the treaty bodies then, or at least the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights, then preparing a compendium of all the recommendations that had been made by treaty bodies, and then for the government to face their peers in the Human Rights Council. We now use their commitments at the end of that process to monitor their sincerity in going to the Human Rights Council. And I think the other positive about the Universal Periodic Review process is that it's a regular a process. That means that we are already moving towards having to go back and account. So although it's imperfect, I think it provides a new voice both for NGOs and communities and human rights commissions and the treaty bodies in a council where a country is required to answer to its peers. So I recognise all the imperfections, but I see a lot of positives coming out of that process.
Thank you. Elizabeth?
Sure. I can comment on this both as I'm the person at USERF who follows the UN, but I also previously worked at an NGO in Geneva, Switzerland that followed UN affairs, and I was in Geneva during the time that the switch over from the Human Rights Commission to the Human Rights Council was going on. And I agree that the UPR is a highly imperfect, the Human Rights Council itself is a highly imperfect body. In terms of the question of politicization, the Council and the UPR as part of it, it is a political body. It is a body of governments. You cannot depoliticize the Human Rights Council. That's just, there were some changes that were made in the switchover. Much of it was moving around the furniture. The UPR, I think, was the biggest change.
A new ceiling.
What's that?
It's a new ceiling.
Exactly. A new, very expensive ceiling. But anyway, so the UPR was the big innovation, but I think it's proving to be a mixed bag at best. I mean, again, it still is a member state run process, and many of those member states are human rights violators. And do not want a real examination of their violations. The good news is it does, require every one of them to undergo it every 4 years. But, of course, a lot of it depends on how seriously the country takes the process. And, a number of countries have seen it as an opportunity to get all their friends to line up and fill the speaker's list and have sort of a mutual praise society where, Cuba's up under review and it gets, a whole lot of other human rights violating countries to come and praise it for its wonderful human rights performance. you know, like my colleague said, there is an avenue for NGOs to submit reports. I think it's one of the best things one can say about it is that in a number of countries, it has sort of empowered local NGOs to participate in that process and to submit reports. But, you know, again, it's still undergoing its first cycle. I think there's, there's been some good, but there's been a lot of bad. One of the big questions, it seems to me, is going to be what follow-up, if any, is there from the recommendations that come out of this? You know, how do you hold a country to recommendations it's supposedly agreed to? What about all the recommendations that a number of countries have refused to agree to? So there are a lot of questions, but, you know, this probably comes from having worked in Geneva for a few years. I'm a Human Rights Council cynic. I don't think one should expect too much from the Human Rights Council.
Anybody else have any?
Yeah, just to let you know, actually, one of the few documents that I brought actually was our annual report card on the Human Rights Council, which actually has a whole section on the UPR. Again, I won't repeat. I agree with everything that my colleagues have said, and I'll just point out a couple of additional things. The idea itself has tremendous merit, and I think for those states who generally have pretty strong political will to do better on human rights issues, the process has proven positive. The consultation process, particularly with NGOs, is instrumental. It requires states to look at a whole broad range of issues on a periodic basis. I will say there's no country in the world that has produced an honest state report that actually legitimately criticizes its genuine human rights challenges. The U.S. just submitted its report recently. It's very much in line with the report that the U.K. had submitted, with France, with the Netherlands, with New Zealand. They're very glossy summaries of all the initiatives that the state is proactively taking to deal with human rights issues, but they're not really hard-hitting human rights reports about what's taking place in the country. Having said that, I don't think that matters. I don't think it's realistic for states to play that role about themselves. That's why there are NGOs. That's why there are special procedures. There are other mechanisms to do that. One of the best things about the UPR is that it basically creates a tremendous archive of all of this documentation that is submitted each time together with this review process. And at least as of now, all of that is maintained on the website of the OHCHR. So you can go in and read every single state. Now, you might need a special degree in finding it on the website, but once you have found it, you can read every single stakeholder report that is submitted, for better or for worse. I mean, there's an issue with the stakeholder reports as well, which is there's an increasing number of non-legitimate gongo, other NGOs that are absolutely ludicrous. On the other hand, most of those within the human rights community know which human rights organizations are credible. Organizations gain credibility because they do honest, consistent monitoring and documenting of human rights abuse issues over time. If they're not honest and credible, then people stop reading them, just like with media outlets. So I reemphasize that point. I mean, if you look at the Cuba, for instance, stakeholder reports, I think there were over 100 stakeholder reports submitted for Cuba. I think the average number is between probably 4 and 10. And most of those organizations were, I would say, a little bit dodgy at best. So the Belarusian, Cuban Friendship Society, I'm not sure, is the most legitimate documenter of human rights abuses in the world. That's okay, because Human Rights Watch and Freedom House and Amnesty and all kinds of really good, solid organizations also submitted reports, and you can read them. And I think, by and large, the OHCHR has done a good job in the compilation documents distilling what legitimate human rights information is from sort of the fluff. Overall, we give the process a mixed review. It's overly peer review. It is very political, of course, because it's a peer review process. So as my colleague says, bad countries line up their buddies to sit there and talk about how wonderful the human rights situation is. On the other hand, the good guys do the same thing. Let's be clear. States are states. There are, though, however, mechanisms through which the real information gets out there. And by and large, I think it's a good thing.
Can I just say one thing? On the African continent, there's also the African peer review mechanism, which is also all the things that you've spoken about. It's imperfect. And one of the gripes that I have with it is that it does not even include a section on freedom of expression and access to information when it's such a big issue on the African continent.
Thank you. I'd like to move to the third question, actually, sure. If I may, because our friend at the mic was very patient.
Yes.
Yeah. So third question on Bosnia, et cetera.
That's a tricky one. I think it's a very good question, so no doubt. who's responsible? The UN and international organizations have a tendency to not see themselves as part of a problem and to not see themselves in the picture, right? And so I think there's a legacy, you know, this is very general, in Bosnia of international organizations not doing what they set out to do, of making empty promises, and not standing by the victims, which I think creates a responsibility then on the long term to sort out the mess that you created. So that's my sort of instinctive response. And I think what you point to is very interesting, proposing the European Convention of Human Rights as a full political program for Bosnian reunification is of course an illusion. And then the first ones to know this are those who are supposed to implement it. You realize that, you know, this is not benevolence, or it's not, you know, this is not a functioning democracy. And maybe it goes back to this issue that you know, human rights in very problematic, very fragmented societies don't deal with the whole issue because of a failure to, you know, fully take into account sort of aggregate problem, minority problems, problems of sharing of power, etc. But you can, you know, talk about the right to vote or freedom of expression as much as you want if you have sort of situation we have right now in Bosnia where sort of the key players simply don't want to play the game. It's just an altogether different issue, and deferring to human rights is just not the solution, I think. Yeah. So.
My name is Kasia Yunbagai. I'm from the Department of Sociology at McGill. And my question comment is basically about the duality we've been grappling with since yesterday and today about the global and the context, and every time this tension arises, it appears to me as if we understand the universality as something as opposed to appreciating the context. I wonder if we go back to what human rights as an institution has done in the West, we could find some way to kind of reconcile that, in the sense that the way I understand human rights as an institution is not so much as us and them, as even though it might be used that way, but as a principle of social inclusion. And sociologically, we have spoken about the political side of the rise of human rights, but basically, I understand what human rights as an institution, the function of it is to act as a principle of social inclusion, as the family, as the basic mechanism for inclusion, gradually loses its capacity to include individual for the entire lifespan in a network of social relations that are providing resources, nutrition, support, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas, actually, I think what human rights in the West has done for the individual is that a protection for the individual who does not have those fixed networks or fixed social positions to be included automatically as somebody and have access for the entire life. But as we go along our life, to school, to healthcare, to access to politics, access to economy, and we have to have something to make sure that that inclusion is guaranteed. And I think that as that function, as a function of social inclusion, if we understand the global scope of human rights, that might also provide a principle of social inclusion for people in those contexts. So going back to the example of that 13-year-old girl in South Africa, I don't know who sent you that call about the case, but assuming if the call had come from the girl, or if the girl was actually asking you not to look at the girl as a member of this family and this tribe that probably usually does that practice of, you know, early marriage of 13-year-olds, but she would ask to be a member, I know, a member of the South African society with those guaranteed rights, what would be the implication of that universal and contextual. And as we see, as the, I guess, the first question was perhaps more to this line, as the sense of empowerment. We know people, for example, in Iran are asking for the right to homosexuality, and women are objecting to polygamy, basically laying claims to those universal aspects, and they want to be included in the global community. So basically, I think when you're talking about the context versus the universal, you're talking about whose primary or whose, which community in which we are a member can lay a claim on us as an individual, or can we say, yes, I am Iranian, yes, I am a member of this tribe, but I'm also human. And am I entitled to the rights that all humans have based on that?
Great question. Anybody want to jump in? Or is there, sorry, is there anyone else who wants to go to the mic so we can group the questions at all? Or?
I have a really quick one, which is I'm a student right now at the University of Connecticut School of Social Work. And so coming into the field, my question is, based on your expertise and your involvement through NGOs and the UN, what do you think that the future of NGO involvement and UN involvement will or should look like? And just kind of your opinion on that.
Does anyone want to jump in first?
I'm happy to jump in a little. I listened a lot to the young people who were in have been running in a parallel process since the beginning of the week, and really at the end of the day, I think there's a sense that there is a, we often talk about balancing particular rights with other rights, but I think what we're learning we need to do is to recognise the relationship between both individual and group rights. And I don't think there's a question about any individual right, any individual universal right being in question. I think they remain important and they must be accessible to everyone. But there's a question of relating those rights to communities and to context and to groups and to beliefs and so on. And I think that's the area that we've been kind of struggling with this week, is that we are not in the process of saying that rights are not universal and that they are not accessible to every person in the world, but that we have to learn, whether we're institutions or advocates or defenders, to find the way of expressing those and of realising those in context and in relationships. So at the end of the day, I think the pressure is there in part to ensure that the group does not swallow the individual, but also that the individual is therefore not dependent on the group, but is recognised as being a part of it. So in the end, I think there's a perception coming through this that we need to recognise the collective as well as the individual, but not at the expense of the individual's right to universal human rights.
I have to liberate you all for lunch, so I'm going to ask the remaining panelists in 30 seconds or less to give their closing comments either to the questions or to anything they've heard.
Just to sort of to I'll say a tiny bit on the question my colleague was answering. In the religious freedom context, we often see this issue of the rights of the individual versus the rights of the group. I mean, religious freedom, it's a right to believe or not to believe as an individual, but it's also the right to manifest that belief in public or in private, alone or in community with others. So that right itself even has a communal aspect. But you do see a conflict, and I mean, you know, we at the Commission have tended to come down on the side of the individual rights because it is a right, and there is a right as part of that right to dissent. I mean, you know, there are instances where religious communities are trying to enforce compliance, or even worse, for our focus, I mean, because we focus on what governments do or don't do, when governments are trying to enforce religious compliance on someone who doesn't want to comply. So I think it's a very important point to make that, yes, there are, there are other group rights as well. Religious freedom has that aspect, but don't let those rights trump the rights of the individual.
Paul?
I agree with both of those comments, and I'm just going to add one point to complement it, although my colleagues may not agree. I think that there is sometimes a tendency to want to group everything that is important and good in the world under the rubric of human rights. And I think the problem of that is that you end up degrading some of the fundamental human rights that people deal with. I think Pansy really raised the right point. We're talking about issues of life and death in some of these cases. Particularly in more free societies, we get in serious debates over some of the nuances under some of these fundamental rights. And that's great, and we should. And that's it's a part of being in this kind of complex, nuanced society. But let's not lose sight of the fact that in certain places it's not an issue of to what degree you can publish information about an individual and whether that person is public or private. In many of these cases, it's just a simple fact that people simply aren't allowed to register at all. They're simply not allowed to print something. They're not allowed to criticize in any way, shape, or form. So I just want to remind people that, you know, and I tell this to people all the time as well about Freedom in the World, the Survey of Political Rights and Civil Liberties. It is not meant to be a guide of everything that is good and important in the world. It is a guide of two areas of life that are very, very good and important in the world.
Well, I think maybe what's interesting is to think about the ways in which we might occasionally deinstitutionalize human rights. Alongside the institutionalization will no doubt go on existing. And to think of all kinds of things that are going on that are not don't refer to human rights as sort of being part of a struggle, and I think that's complementary to what you just said. For example, there's a number of economic and social struggles that are going on the world over that may not use the language of human rights, which we shouldn't necessarily force to use the language of human rights, yet whose success will be absolutely crucial for the enjoyment of human rights. And so I think it's important not to excessively focus on just rights. Yeah.
I think the issue of universality and context, it's a debate that we should continue to have, and that's my parting shot.
I'm sorry I got you out late. Thank you, sir, for your patience. Thanks for your attention. Enjoy.